A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
3 weeks ago, CENTCOM's official social media accounts were posting videos of airstrikes obliterating IRGC command facilities. Operation Epic Fury. The caption was, quote, "No mercy." This week, J.D. Vance announces that CENTCOM will sit down for direct military-to-military talks with the IRGC in Qatar.
That's not a policy shift. That's a neck brace.
It is genuinely hard to think of a faster 180 in modern American foreign policy. Daniel sent us this one because he sees the connection that a lot of coverage is missing. He's asking what this means for Israel's war with Iran, whether this gets read as the ultimate act of betrayal, and whether Netanyahu's comment this same week about decreasing dependence on U.S. military supplies is the real signal underneath all of it.
The timing on that Netanyahu line is not accidental. He told troops explicitly to reduce reliance on American military hardware in the same news cycle as the Vance announcement. That's not a coincidence. That's a response.
We're going to walk through the mechanics of how you even negotiate with a group you've legally designated as terrorists, while your own military is still bombing them. Then we'll get to what this means for Israel's strategic calculus, the nuclear question, and what concrete steps a country takes when it starts planning for a world without American backing.
Before any of that, I just want to sit with the sheer velocity of this reversal. CENTCOM was not doing subtle signaling 3 weeks ago. They were posting killshot highlight reels.
And it's not like the IRGC suddenly became a different organization. They are still officially designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. That designation has been in place since April 2019. First time the U.S. ever slapped the FTO label on part of another sovereign government's military.
The designation wasn't just symbolic. It criminalized material support to the IRGC under U.S. law. It authorized sanctions on anyone doing business with them. It put the IRGC in the same legal category as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So now you have the same military command that was legally empowered to destroy this organization sitting down at a table with them.
The whiplash is the point. Because if you're an ally watching this, you don't just update your assessment of the specific Iran policy. You update your assessment of how fast the entire framework can invert.
And that's what Daniel is flagging. He wrote that this move will be read as the ultimate act of betrayal, and that the idea of the U.S. as a reliable partner in frustrating a nuclear Iran now seems implausible. It's not that the U.S. has never shifted positions before. It's the speed. No intermediate phase, no gradual de-escalation, no public signaling that talks were being explored, just airstrike videos 1 month, negotiating table the next.
It's the foreign policy equivalent of a car going from 60 miles an hour to reverse with no clutch.
Here's the thing. This didn't come from nowhere. The machinery that enables this kind of pivot has been in place for a long time. The legal architecture, the diplomatic back channels, the mediating states. Those were all built for exactly this kind of situation. What's unusual is that they're being used so publicly and so abruptly.
Let's talk about that machinery. The first question Daniel's prompt raises is the most basic one. How do you even do this legally? The IRGC is a designated foreign terrorist organization. U.S. law prohibits material support, and that includes things like providing tactical information, or even just sitting in a room discussing operational matters. So what's the workaround?
There are actually several. The most straightforward is a national security waiver. The Secretary of State has the authority to issue waivers for specific activities if they determine it's in the national security interest. These waivers don't revoke the FTO designation. They just carve out a narrow exception for a specific purpose. So you can maintain that the IRGC is a terrorist organization while simultaneously authorizing CENTCOM officers to meet with them. Legally, it's awkward, but not impossible.
Awkward is one word for it.
Another mechanism is third-party mediation. If the talks are technically hosted by Qatar and the U.S. is participating in a Qatari-led process, the legal framing shifts slightly. The U.S. isn't negotiating with terrorists. It's participating in a multilateral dialogue facilitated by a neutral party. That's a distinction that matters to lawyers, even if it doesn't matter to anyone else.
Qatar is not a random choice here. They host Al Udeidi Air Base, the largest U.S. military installation in the Middle East. They maintain open channels with Tehran. They brokered prisoner swaps and hostage releases before. They are the designated pressure release valve in the region.
And this is where the U.S.-Taliban precedent becomes relevant. In 2020, the Trump administration negotiated directly with the Taliban in Doha. The Taliban were designated under an executive order. The legal mechanism was similar. Special waivers, Qatari mediation, and a very narrow scope for the talks. The difference here is that the Taliban talks were about withdrawal. These IRGC talks are happening while active combat operations are ongoing. That's a much stranger situation.
That's the part I think Daniel is really getting at. It's not just that the U.S. is talking to a designated terrorist organization. It's that they're doing it while CENTCOM is still actively bombing that organization's facilities. The cognitive dissonance is staggering.
Let me put some sharper edges on that. During Operation Epic Fury, CENTCOM wasn't just conducting strikes. They were running an information campaign alongside it. The social media posts were designed to project strength and resolve. The messaging was explicitly about destroying IRGC capabilities. Commanders were giving interviews about degrading their naval and missile forces. And then, within weeks, those same commanders or their colleagues are supposed to sit across a table and negotiate in good faith.
What does that do to troop morale? You spend weeks telling your people that this enemy must be destroyed, that there will be no mercy, and then suddenly it's time for diplomacy.
It's actually worse for the Allies than it is for U.S. troops. U.S. forces are trained to follow orders and adapt to mission changes. But if you're an Israeli defense planner, you built your entire strategic framework around the assumption that the United States is a consistent and reliable partner. You've made procurement decisions, basing decisions, operational planning decisions, all predicated on continued U.S. support. And now you're watching the U.S. flip its posture in real time with no warning and no consultation.
Which brings us to the Netanyahu comment. Daniel flagged this specifically. In the same week as the Vance announcement, Netanyahu emphasized to Israeli troops the importance of decreasing dependence on U.S. military supplies. That is not a throwaway line from a prime minister known for careful public messaging. That is a signal.
It's a signal to multiple audiences simultaneously. To the Israeli defense establishment, it's a directive to accelerate domestic production and diversify supply chains. To the United States, it's a warning that Israel is not a captive client and has options. And to the Israeli public, it's preparing them for a future that looks different from the past 75 years of strategic partnership.
To Iran, presumably, it's a message that whatever happens in the Qatar talks, Israel's red lines are not up for negotiation.
But let's be concrete about what decreasing dependence actually means. Israel is not going to stop using American equipment tomorrow. The F-35 fleet, the refueling tankers, the precision-guided munitions, the intelligence-sharing arrangements, those are deeply integrated and can't be replaced quickly. What Netanyahu is signaling is a shift in procurement strategy and a build-out of domestic alternatives over time.
The Arrow missile defense system is a good example. It's jointly developed with the U.S., and certain components are only manufactured in America. Iron Beam, the laser defense system, was designed with significant U.S. technology transfer. Untangling those dependencies is a multi-year project.
It's a project that now has political urgency behind it, and that's the real story here. Daniel's prompt gets at something deeper than just one weird policy reversal. He's asking whether the fundamental assumption of the U.S.-Israel relationship has changed. And I think the answer, based on what we've seen in the past 72 hours, is that the assumption is now being actively questioned by both sides.
Let's pull on that thread. If you're an Israeli defense planner right now, what scenarios are you suddenly modeling that you weren't modeling a month ago?
The big one is a scenario where the U.S. reaches some kind of accommodation with Iran that leaves Israel's nuclear red lines unenforced. If the Qatar talks lead to any form of de-escalation or normalization, the U.S. might be reluctant to support Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. That leaves Israel in a position where it has to enforce its own red lines unilaterally.
Unilateral enforcement of a nuclear red line is a much harder military problem than joint enforcement. The U.S. provides bunker-busting munitions, intelligence, refueling, and diplomatic cover. Without those, the operational challenges multiply.
That's exactly the kind of scenario that was once considered fringe. The idea that the U.S. might not support Israel in a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities was something you'd hear from the most pessimistic analysts. But now, with direct U.S. IRGC talks happening, that scenario moves from the fringe to the planning baseline.
Daniel's point about the betrayal narrative is important here. It's not just about the operational implications, it's about the psychological and political impact. For decades, the U.S.-Israel relationship has been framed as ironclad. That framing has shaped Israeli strategic culture, procurement decisions, and diplomatic posture. If that framing cracks, the effects ripple through every aspect of Israeli national security.
There's a comparison here to what happened with Turkey and the F-35 program. When the U.S. cut Turkey out of the F-35 consortium over the S-400 purchase, Turkey accelerated its domestic drone program. The Bayraktar TB2 went from being an interesting indigenous project to a globally significant combat drone within a few years. The principle is the same. When a country realizes its access to American technology is not guaranteed, it invests in alternatives.
Israel's defense industry is far more advanced than Turkey's was at the time of that split. Israel already produces world-class systems. Iron Dome, Trophy Active Protection, the Merkava tank, a range of missiles and drones. The industrial base is there. What's been missing is the political will to fully decouple from American supply chains, because decoupling is expensive and politically awkward.
That political calculus may have just changed. When your prime minister is publicly telling troops to reduce dependence on American supplies, the political will is being manufactured in real time.
Let's step back and look at the whole picture Daniel is painting. The U.S. is negotiating directly with a designated terrorist organization while still bombing them. Israel's prime minister is signaling a strategic decoupling from American military supply chains. And all of this is happening against the backdrop of an ongoing war with Iran and the unresolved nuclear question. That's not a normal week in foreign policy.
It's not even a normal year. And I think what makes this particularly unsettling is that none of the standard frameworks explain it. If this were a coordinated strategy, there would have been signaling. There would have been consultations with allies. There would have been a gradual shift. Instead, it looks like the right hand and the left hand are operating in completely different realities.
Or operating in the same reality, but with different timelines and different constituencies. CENTCOM's social media campaign was aimed at a domestic audience and at adversaries. The Qatar talks are aimed at de-escalation and possibly at creating off-ramps. The contradiction might not be a failure of coordination. It might be a deliberate strategy of maintaining maximum pressure while opening a back channel.
That's possible. But if it's deliberate, it's a strategy that imposes enormous costs on allies who are asked to trust American consistency. You can't simultaneously tell Israel that you're committed to preventing a nuclear Iran and then open direct talks with the organization that controls Iran's nuclear program without creating a crisis of confidence.
That's the core of Daniel's prompt. The crisis of confidence is not a future risk. It's happening now. The Netanyahu statement is evidence that it's already shaping Israeli decision-making. The question is, how far and how fast this decoupling goes, and what it means for the balance of power in the Middle East.
I want to flag one more thing before we move into the deeper analysis. The Qatar talks are being framed as military to military. That's significant. These aren't diplomatic talks led by the State Department. These are talks between uniformed officers. That suggests the agenda is operational. Avoiding accidental escalation. Maybe prisoner exchanges. It's not a peace negotiation.
Which means the talks could produce concrete operational outcomes without resolving any of the underlying political disputes. You could have a deconfliction hotline between CEC while the broader conflict continues. That's a weird outcome, but it's not unprecedented.
It's worth noting that military-to-military talks can actually increase the pressure on Israel in a paradoxical way. If the U.S. and Iran establish reliable channels to prevent escalation between their own forces, that reduces the risk of a wider war, which, counterintuitively, might give Iran more freedom of action against Israel because the risk of triggering a U.S.-Iran confrontation is lower.
That's a dark read, but it's logically consistent. If the US and Iran are talking, and if those talks reduce the chance of direct US-Iran conflict, then Iran's calculus on actions against Israel shifts. The deterrent effect of American military power becomes less certain.
Which loops right back to Netanyahu's comment about reducing dependence. If American deterrence is no longer reliably backing Israeli security, then Israel needs its own deterrence. And that means domestic production, independent strike capabilities, and a strategic posture that doesn't assume American backup.
Daniel's prompt has identified a genuine inflection point. The Vance announcement and the Netanyahu statement are two sides of the same coin. One side is the US signaling that its posture toward Iran is more fluid than anyone assumed. The other side is Israel signaling that it's preparing for a world where American support is not guaranteed. Together, they represent a fundamental shift in the architecture of Middle Eastern security.
We haven't even gotten to the nuclear dimension yet. If the US is in direct talks with the IRGC, what happens to the joint US-Israel effort to prevent a nuclear Iran? The US was the primary enforcer of sanctions. It was the provider of the bunker-busting munitions that would be needed for any strike on hardened nuclear facilities. If those talks lead to any form of accommodation, Israel's nuclear red lines become unilateral and much harder to enforce.
That's where we're headed next, but I think it's worth pausing here and just acknowledging how much has changed in a single news cycle. 3 weeks ago, the story was American air power destroying Iranian military infrastructure. Today, the story is American officers sitting down with the organization they were just bombing. And the country most affected by this reversal is already signaling that it's rethinking its entire strategic posture.
The speed is the story. Policy reversals happen. But the velocity of this one and the lack of allied consultation is what makes it different. It's not the substance of the talks that's most alarming to Israel. It's the message that American commitments can evaporate without warning.
Once that message is received, it can't be unreceived. Even if the Qatar talks go nowhere, even if the US reaffirms its commitment to Israeli security, the demonstration effect has already happened. Israel now knows that the US can and will flip its posture on a dime. That knowledge doesn't go away.
Which is why the Netanyahu statement is so significant. It's not just a reaction to this specific event. It's an acknowledgement that the strategic environment has permanently changed. The era of unquestioned American security guarantees in the Middle East may not be over yet, but the question marks are now visible to everyone. Let's lay out the full timeline, because the sequence itself tells you something about how strange this is. April 2019, the State Department designates the IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization. First time ever for part of a sovereign government's military. That's the legal baseline.
It wasn't controversial in the sense of being rushed or poorly considered. There were hearings, legal reviews, interagency debates. The designation stuck because it reflected a genuine assessment that the IRGC operates like a terrorist organization. It funds proxies. It conducts attacks through deniable assets. It has killed American service members.
Fast forward to early 2026. CENTCOM launches Operation Epic Fury. The stated objective is destroying IRGC naval and missile capabilities. This is not a limited strike package. It's a named operation with a campaign plan, targeting cycles, and a public information component. The messaging is unambiguous.
Then June 2026. J.D. Vance announces DirectCom. RGC talks in Qatar. No intermediate phase. No trial balloon floated in the press. No allied consultations that anyone can point to. Just a hard cut from bombing run to negotiating table.
That sequence creates a puzzle that goes beyond normal policy analysis. How does a state negotiate with an organization it has legally designated as terrorist while its own military is actively conducting strikes against that organization? That's not policy evolution. It's a rupture in the logic of how state action is supposed to work.
The rupture is what Daniel's zeroing in on. He's not asking whether this is good or bad policy. He's asking what it means when the framework itself can invert this fast. Because if you're an ally, you don't just adjust your estimate of the Iran file. You adjust your estimate of American predictability across the board.
There are really only three ways to read what these talks actually are. The first is a back channel, narrow scope, operational focus, designed to prevent miscalculation. Think deconfliction hotline, not diplomacy. The second is a ceasefire negotiation. Broader scope, aimed at halting or freezing active hostilities. The third is something more structural. A genuine attempt to reset the U.S.-Iran relationship, with the IRGC as the actual power center being engaged.
The framing is military to military rather than diplomatic suggests the first read is most likely. But here's the problem. The IRGC doesn't separate cleanly from Iranian state decision-making. You can't have an operational deconfliction channel with the IRGC that doesn't also become a political channel, because the IRGC is the political center of gravity in Iran.
And that's the ambiguity that makes this so unsettling for Israel. If these are just technical talks about avoiding accidental clashes, that's one thing. If they become the foundation for a broader U.S.-Iran understanding that leaves Israel's concerns unaddressed, that's something else entirely. And from the outside, you can't tell which one you're watching until it's already happened. How do you actually do this legally? The IRGC is an FTO. The law says you can't provide material support, and sitting in a room discussing operational matters arguably crosses that line. But there's a mechanism that's been used before, and it's almost certainly what's being activated here.
Walk me through it.
The Secretary of State can issue a national security waiver for specific activities. It doesn't revoke the designation. The IRGC remains a terrorist organization on paper. But for this narrow purpose, for this specific set of meetings, the legal prohibition is suspended. It's a carve-out, not a reversal.
The designation stays in place. Sanctions stay in place. The legal finding that they're a terrorist organization remains. But we just sort of looked the other way for this one conversation.
That's the basic shape of it. And it's been done before. The U.S. Taliban talks in Doha in 2020 used a similar framework. The Taliban weren't an FTO, but they were designated under a separate executive order. Special waivers were issued. Qatari mediation provided an additional legal buffer. The talks were framed as a multilateral process, not direct U.S. terrorist negotiations.
The Taliban talks were about withdrawal. The fighting was winding down. Here, CENTCOM is still actively striking IRGC targets. That's a different legal and operational universe.
And that's what makes the waiver here more strained. The national security exception is typically invoked when the talks themselves are aimed at reducing the threat. Deconfliction, prisoner swaps, preventing escalation. The argument would be that sitting down with the IRGC serves the national security interest precisely because it reduces the risk of a wider war. But you're doing it while the bombing continues. That's a harder sell legally, even if the waiver authority technically covers it.
What about the third-party angle? Does Qatar hosting the talks change the legal calculus?
It helps at the margins. If the talks are formally a Qatari-led process and the U.S. is a participant rather than the convener, the legal framing shifts slightly. The U.S. isn't initiating contact with a terrorist organization. It's responding to an invitation from a neutral party to discuss operational matters. That distinction matters to lawyers at the State Department, even if it looks identical from the outside.
Qatar is uniquely positioned to play that role. They host Al Udeid, the largest American airbase in the region. They've got open lines to Tehran that most Gulf states don't. They've brokered prisoner exchanges before. They're the address you call when you need to talk to someone you can't be seen talking to.
Qatar has essentially built its foreign policy around being the indispensable mediator. They hosted the Taliban's political office in Doha for years. They've facilitated talks between the U.S. and groups that no one else would touch. This is not a bug in their strategy. It's the feature.
You've got the legal architecture, the waiver, the third-party framing, and you've got the diplomatic architecture in Qatar. But there's a third piece Daniel's question gets at that's less about law and more about psychology. CENTCOM was posting kill shot videos 3 weeks ago. What does it do to the credibility of those operations when the same command sits down with the target?
It undermines the information campaign retroactively. Those social media posts weren't just for public consumption. They were signals to allies and adversaries about American resolve. The message was, we are committed to destroying this organization. And now the message is, we are committed to talking to this organization. You can't unsend that first message.
There's a term for this in deterrence theory. When a protector's commitments become ambiguous, the protected party has to reassess its own exposure. That's exactly what we're seeing with the Netanyahu statement.
Decoupling doesn't require the U.S. to actually abandon Israel. It just requires enough ambiguity that Israeli planners can't be certain. The Qatar talks create that ambiguity regardless of what's actually discussed in the room. The mere fact of the meeting shifts the probability distribution.
Because from Israel's perspective, they have to price in the worst case. If there's even a 20% chance that these talks lead to a U.S.-Iran accommodation that leaves Israel exposed, that 20% has to be planned for. You can't wait until it's 100% and then start building missile factories.
And this connects to the operational signaling problem. CENTCOM spent weeks telling its own forces that the IRGC was an existential threat that needed to be destroyed. Commanders gave interviews. Targeting packages were assembled. Pilots flew sorties. And then, without any transitional phase, the same organization becomes a negotiating partner. For the troops on the ground, that's not just confusing. It raises questions about whether the mission they were just executing was as urgent as they were told.
Morale is one dimension, but I think the Allied trust dimension is actually bigger. U.S. troops are professionals. They'll adapt. But if you're an Emirati or Saudi or Israeli defense official, you're now asking yourself a question you didn't think you'd need to ask. If they can flip on the IRGC this fast, could they flip on us?
That's the corrosive effect. It's not that any specific ally thinks they're about to be abandoned tomorrow. It's that the demonstrated speed of the reversal changes everyone's planning assumptions. You start hedging. You start diversifying suppliers. You start building independent capabilities. Not because you expect betrayal, but because you've now seen that the machinery for rapid reversal exists and can be activated without warning.
Once allies start hedging, the alliance itself becomes less valuable to the U.S. It's a self-reinforcing cycle. Less trust leads to less coordination, leads to less trust. The Qatar talks might be narrowly focused on deconfliction, but the knock-on effect ripples through every U.S. security partnership in the region.
There's one more piece of the legal machinery worth flagging. The FTO designation isn't just a label. It criminalizes a whole range of activities. Financial transactions, travel, material support. So even with a national security waiver for the talks themselves, you have practical questions. Are the IRGC officers traveling to Qatar subject to visa restrictions? Are they on sanctions lists that would prevent them from using the banking system to pay for their hotels? The logistical absurdities pile up fast.
I am now picturing an IRGC general trying to check into a Doha hotel with a U.S. sanctions flag on his name and the front desk computer freezing.
It's almost certainly handled through Qatari facilitation. The Qataris provide the venue, the logistics, the financial arrangements. The U.S. participants don't directly provide anything of material value. But the legal line is thin, and everyone in the room knows it.
The machinery works, but it's creaking. The waiver exists, the third-party framework exists, the president exists. But none of it was designed for a situation where the bombing is still happening. That's the novel part.
That's the mechanics of the talks themselves. But the real story isn't in Doha, it's in Tel Aviv, where planners are already running a very different set of scenarios.
Daniel flagged the Netanyahu statement specifically. Same week as the Vance announcement, the Prime Minister tells Israeli troops to decrease dependence on American military supplies. That's not a rhetorical flourish. That's a planning directive dressed as a public remark.
The timing eliminates coincidence. You don't publicly tell your military to start decoupling from your primary ally's supply chain unless you've already concluded that the risk of dependency outweighs the cost of decoupling. That conclusion doesn't form in a vacuum. It forms when you watch a video of American officers sitting down with the organization that runs Iran's nuclear program.
Let's put some specificity on what decreasing dependence actually means. Israel's most advanced systems are deeply entangled with American manufacturing. The Arrow Missile Defense Interceptor, joint development with Boeing. Iron Beam, the laser defense system, significant U.S. technology transfer. The F-35 fleet, entirely American. Precision-guided munitions, American. Aerial refueling tankers, American. Intelligence fusion platforms, American.
None of that could be replaced next year. But the Netanyahu signal isn't about next year, it's about the 10-year procurement horizon. When you're deciding today what your Air Force looks like in 2035, you now have to model a scenario where American parts aren't guaranteed. That changes which systems you invest in, which domestic programs you accelerate, and which foreign suppliers you cultivate.
There's a comparison Daniel's prompt brings to mind, the Turkey F-35 crisis. When the U.S. cut Turkey from the Joint Strike Fighter program over the S-400 purchase, the assumption was that Turkish air power would atrophy. Instead, Turkey poured resources into the Bayraktar drone program and the Khan 5th generation fighter. The Bayraktar TB2 went from an interesting indigenous project to a combat-proven platform that's been exported to 30 countries.
Israel's defense industry is starting from a much higher baseline than Turkey's was. Iron Dome, trophy active protection on the Merkava, the entire missile and drone ecosystem. These are world-class systems already in production. The missing piece hasn't been industrial capability. It's been political willingness to pay the cost of decoupling, because American systems are cheaper when you factor in foreign military financing, and the diplomatic friction of saying no to American hardware is real.
The political calculus just shifted. When your prime minister is telling troops publicly to reduce dependence, he's also telling the defense ministry to prioritize domestic alternatives even when they're more expensive. That's a budget fight that was previously unwinnable. Now it has the prime minister's explicit backing.
This connects directly to the nuclear question. If the U.S. is now talking to the IRGC, what happens to the joint effort to prevent a nuclear Iran? The U.S. was the primary enforcer of sanctions. It provided the bunker-busting munitions that any strike on hardened facilities would require. It supplied the intelligence and the refueling. If those talks lead to any form of accommodation, Israel's nuclear red lines become unilateral.
Unilateral enforcement of a nuclear red line is a fundamentally different military problem. Without American bunker busters, you need more sorties, higher risk, and a greater chance that some facilities survive the first wave. Without American refueling, your strike radius shrinks. Without American diplomatic cover, the aftermath is lonelier.
This is the scenario that was once considered the preserve of catastrophists. The idea that Israel might have to strike Iranian nuclear facilities without American support, or even over American objections, that was fringe analysis. But if CENTCOM is sitting down with the IRGC, and if those talks produce operational understandings, the fringe scenario migrates toward the center of the planning distribution.
Daniel's word was betrayal. I think that's accurate, not because the U.S. has formally abandoned any commitments, but because the structure of the relationship has been revealed as conditional in a way that wasn't priced in before. The condition was always there in theory. Every alliance is conditional. But the speed of this reversal demonstrates that the conditions can flip faster than procurement cycles can adjust.
Betrayal is a relational concept, not just a policy concept. It's about trust. The U.S. spent decades building a reputation as a reliable security partner. That reputation wasn't built on any single commitment. It was built on consistency over time. A single announcement can't erase it. But it can crack the foundation, and the Netanyahu statement suggests the crack is already visible from Jerusalem.
What does hedging actually look like in practice? If you're Israel and you're now planning for a world where American support is partial or absent, what do you accelerate?
First, domestic production of critical munitions. Israel already manufactures its own small-diameter bombs and some precision-guided systems, but the stockpiles for a sustained campaign against hardened targets aren't there yet. You accelerate those production lines. Second, you diversify suppliers, Germany, India, South Korea, countries with advanced defense industries that aren't the United States. Third, you pre-position. If you can't count on resupply during a conflict, you need larger stockpiles before the conflict starts.
The Arrow system is the case study that makes this concrete. The Arrow 3 interceptor is designed to hit ballistic missiles in space. It was developed jointly with Boeing. Certain components are manufactured only in the United States and can't be replicated quickly. If those components become unavailable, Israel doesn't lose the entire Arrow system, but it loses the production pipeline for new interceptors. That's the kind of vulnerability that keeps defense planners awake.
This is where I think Daniel's prompt gives us a practical framework, not just an analytical one. If you're tracking this story, there are three specific signals to watch in the next 30 days that will tell you whether this is a tactical back channel or a genuine strategic pivot.
Walk me through them.
First, any change to the IRGC's FTO status. Not a full revocation, that's politically impossible this fast. But watch for a quiet modification, a new waiver that broadens the scope of permitted contact. A State Department legal opinion that reinterprets what material support means. Bureaucratic moves that don't make headlines but change what's legally possible.
You're not looking for a press release saying we've changed our mind about the IRGC. You're looking for a footnote in a Federal Register notice.
The second signal is Israeli defense procurement announcements outside U.S. systems. The Netanyahu statement is the political signal. The procurement contracts are the operational follow-through. If you see Israel sign a new missile production deal with a European or Asian supplier in the next few weeks, that's not a coincidence. That's the decoupling moving from rhetoric to contract.
The third signal?
Qatar's role expanding beyond mediation into something that looks like security guarantees. If the Qataris start offering formal assurances about Iranian compliance, or if they become the designated channel for verifying any agreements that come out of these talks, that's a structural shift. Qatar moves from hosting the meeting to being part of the enforcement mechanism.
That's a useful triage. Most coverage of this story is going to focus on the drama, the betrayal narrative, the political fallout. But those three signals tell you whether the architecture is actually changing or whether this is just a weird one-off.
The broader lesson here, the one that applies beyond this specific crisis, is that alliances are not binary. The U.S. can simultaneously bomb and negotiate with the same actor. That sounds contradictory, but it's not. It's what happens when different parts of a large government pursue different objectives on different timelines. The question isn't whether the contradiction exists. It's what conditions produced it.
Operational necessity, domestic political pressure, or grand strategy shift. Those are the three buckets, and they're not mutually exclusive. You could have a CENTCOM commander who believes deconfliction reduces risk to American forces, a vice president who sees domestic advantage in being the peacemaker, and a long-term strategic calculation that a contained Iran is preferable to a collapsed one. All three can be true at once.
The practical takeaway for anyone who follows this region is to stop treating U.S.-Israel relations as a static given. The contingency planning that was once fringe is now mainstream. If you're building scenario models, you now need at least one where U.S. support is partial or absent. Not because that's the most likely outcome, but because it's no longer a rounding error.
That's the thing Daniel's prompt really nails. He's not asking us to predict what happens in the Qatar talks. He's pointing out that the mere fact of the talks changes the distribution of possible futures. And once that distribution shifts, you have to plan differently.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the Tang Dynasty, imperial edicts were sometimes transmitted via a relay system of bells and drums that could carry a signal over 500 kilometers in a single day. The acoustic properties of the bronze bells were calibrated to specific resonant frequencies that cut through wind and terrain noise, effectively functioning as a pre-modern broadcast network.
One question that's been nagging at me through all of this. If the U.S. is talking to the IRGC, who else might they talk to? Does this set a precedent for engagement with other designated groups?
It does, and that's probably the most under-discussed implication of the whole thing. The legal machinery we walked through, the national security waiver, the third-party mediation, the narrow operational scope, that's a template. It's not specific to the IRGC. Any designated group where the U.S. sees an operational need for contact now has a clearer path to the table.
The precedent isn't that the U.S. will talk to anyone. It's that the machinery exists and has been activated. Future decisions about engagement become easier, not because the politics are easier, but because the legal pathway is already mapped.
The Qatar talks demonstrate something else. You don't need a peace process to justify direct contact. You just need an operational rationale that can be framed as reducing risk to American forces. That's a much lower bar.
The next 12 months are going to tell us whether this is a tactical pause or a genuine strategic pivot. Either way, I think Daniel's prompt identified something that's already locked in. The era of unquestioned American security guarantees in the Middle East is over.
Not because the guarantees have been formally revoked, because the question marks are now visible. And once a question mark becomes visible, every ally has to plan as if the answer might be no. That's not catastrophism, that's basic risk management.
The Netanyahu statement is the proof that it's already happening. Israel isn't waiting to see how the Qatar talks play out. It's already adjusting. That adjustment will have its own momentum, its own procurement logic, its own diplomatic consequences. The decoupling doesn't require American permission.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.